Welcome to today's Pediatric Insight, sponsored by Career Physician and the Child Health Advisory Council. I'm Bruder Stapleton, chair of the Child Health Advisory Council. Today we're hearing from Frederick Rivara. Dr. Rivara is professor of pediatrics at the University of Washington and vice chair of the Department of Pediatrics, as well as an adjunct professor in the Department of Epidemiology in the School of Public Health. He holds the Seattle Children's Endowed Chair in Pediatric Research. Dr. Rivara is a world-known expert in the area of injury prevention, has received many awards, including the Lifetime Spencer Award from the CDC for his work and contributions. He edited the journal JAMA Pediatrics for over 17 years and was the founding editor of JAMA Open. Dr. Rivara has received many awards, including the Distinguished Alumnus Award from the School of Public Health at the University of Washington, and most recently, the Distinguished Medical Alumnus from the University of Pennsylvania School of Medicine. Dr. Rivara was elected to the Institute of Medicine in 2005 and has chaired many important committees related to child health for the Academy. Most recently, in 2002, he chaired the intensive review of the impending shortage and current shortage of pediatric specialty workforce. So Dr. Rivara's talk today will focus on that committee's report on the future of the pediatric subspecialty workforce. So we look forward to your discussion today, Dr. Rivara, and thanks for being here.
Thanks very much for the chance to talk with you all. I really appreciate it. As Dr. Stapleton said, this was grew out my term as the chair of the National Academy of Science and Engineering Medicine Committee on the Pediatric Subspecialty Workforce. We don't get any compensation for that. I have no other conflicts of interest to disclose. So we'll really talk about how this really affects all of us in pediatric medicine nowadays. And I start with this slide, which I came across this recently, which is startling, that 77% of our youth can qualify for service because of various medical, mental health problems. 77% can't qualify. So that really indicates that we have a problem in delivering healthcare to people in our country. And when we think about healthcare, what is our vision for high quality healthcare? It's that it's accessible and efficient, enables all children to receive the appropriate type and amount of primary and special care whenever they need it. And in terms of high quality care, we think about the six elements of quality that was defined by the Institute of Medicine many years ago: safety, timeliness, effectiveness, efficiency, equity, and patient-centeredness. There are a number of challenges when we think about pediatric subspecialty care that have arisen. The number of kids in the United States has really not changed over the last couple of decades, really around 72, 73 million kids in the United States. But the healthcare needs of those have certainly changed. And those of us who have gray hair remember what our hospitals looked like 20 or 30 years ago, very different patient population than we see nowadays if we go on the wards. There's certainly changes in referral patterns for care of children and the organization of services. We know that pediatric care in particular has become more centralized, that many hospitals are no longer providing pediatric care or obstetrical care, and therefore the referral patterns for care of these children have changed. There is great demand, great difficulty meeting the demand for subspecialty care. All of us, if we try to refer a child to be evaluated for autism in any children's hospital in the country, there'll be periods of waiting from 6 to 12 months for that child to be seen. And there's problematic financing in children's healthcare, despite nearly all children being insured. And we'll talk a little bit more about that in a minute, and that may get worse in the current administration. We also know that there's changes to our workforce. They have changes, needs, desires, and demands. And we have to deal with those in our everyday leadership of our departments and our programs. And we're still seeing the long-term effects of the pandemic. So the cumulative effects of all of these have created large challenges for all of us in delivering pediatric care. And that's contributed to high rates of burnout. 55% of pediatric specialists say they have burnout. And a higher proportion of those are women than men reporting burnout symptoms. So that's a real concern. And it's led to, I think, this next slide, which is, this was a study published in JAMA-NERC Open 2 years ago. And it asked for pediatric specialists, what portion of you feel like you will leave your institution within the next 2 years? And you can see it's like 25 to 30% of these subspecialists say they're going to leave their institution next 2 years. It may not truly happen, but it certainly indicates a sense of discontent on the part of those individuals. And you get down to then the question of who's going to take their place. And the data here are really quite concerning. You can see the number of pediatric resident applications. This is of AAMC data. And you can see that the number of MD applicants has decreased fairly significantly from 2020 to 2024 and 2025. That's taken up, made up a little bit by number of international medical graduates has increased somewhat. The number of DOs has increased somewhat. But overall, the number of pediatric resident applicants has actually gone down from what was 2020. It's gone up in the last year from what it was in 2023, but that's a concern. And then that really reflects what's happening with our pediatric fellowship applicants. You can see that the number of pediatric subspecialty applicants in the bottom row is now lower in 2025 than it was in 2022. And some of these subspecialty programs really have a dearth of pediatric applicants. On pediatric emergency medicine, which has been quite popular, you can see that it went down from 320 to 218 in 2025. Pediatric gastroenterology even went down. And so if you look at in the 2024 cycle, the number of subspecialty fellowships that filled compared to the number of positions available, all of these have fewer applicants than positions except for cardiology and hospital medicine, which is really pretty remarkable. And you look at it by the subspecialty types here, you can see adolescent medicine, only 80% of the positions were filled. Child abuse in 2024, 60% were filled. In 2025, 30% were filled. There were 10 applicants for 30 positions nationally. Developmental behavioral pediatrics, endocrinology, you can see that 40% of those positions go unfilled. In pediatric nephrology back in 24, there were 60% were filled, but in 2025, only 37% of pediatric nephrology fellowship positions were filled, 37%. Pulmonary, again, in rheumatology, 40% went unfilled. One of the big problems is physician compensation. In the famous words in Jerry Maguire, show me the money. And this is a graph put together by Gary Fried from the University of Michigan, looking at the lifetime relative net present values by subspecialty. And the zero line is at general pediatricians. This is individuals both in practice in the community as well as in our academic medical centers. As a general pediatrician, I thought I was always relatively underpaid, but apparently not. You can see that neonatal medicine, cardiology, cardiac intensive care, they have much higher rates of reimbursement over the lifetime than do anybody else, and therefore have pretty good fill rates. On the other hand, you look at adolescent medicine, child and developmental behavioral pediatrics, rheumatology, endocrinology, infectious diseases, their reimbursement is really much lower. And therefore, those are the individuals that are not filling our subspecialty positions. Those are the ones we're having hard to fill those fellowship slots and also hard to recruit in our practices. What about outpatient care? And this is a really startling slide if you think about it. So this is data from PEDSNET run by Chris Forrest at CHOP. And you can see the slides down, the hospitals down at the bottom of the slide that participate in this, including Seattle Children's Hospital, CHOP, Cincinnati, Nationwide. And you can see these are data that show what are the three most common problems that individuals in those specialties are seeing. Look at pediatric gastroenterology. The three most common problems are constipation, GE reflux, and feeding problems. In pediatric cardiology, it's heart murmur, chest pain, and palpitations. So these are problems that, frankly, these individuals should not have to see. These are problems that should be taken care of by a general pediatrician. Why a general pediatrician is referring a child with constipation to pediatric GI is a mystery to me, but it also results in those individuals that really need to see a pediatric GI doc can't see them because they're taking care of problems that general pediatricians should see. So I think this has important implications both for our training programs as well as for our hospitals and how they manage these complaints and these requests for appointments. So are there any questions at this point?
Where did you get most of the data? Was that from the board or did you feel that the data were adequate to make these observations or do you think that there should be a better assessment of the data? Are you pretty comfortable with that?
I think, Dr. Edwards, there should be a better data available. I think that the data we had was somewhat old. Some of it came from Pete's net, as I showed you that slide. Chris Forrest did some runs for us. Some of it's from the published literature. We actually weren't able to get data from the board. The board folks testified before us, but they were on their own timeline for producing a report, which came out last year in Journal of, I guess it was Pediatrics, they had a special supplement. They did not provide the data to us ahead of time. There are problems getting data, as you might expect. Danielle?
The question that kind of jumps to mind is, what are the direct implications for medical education? I can tell you that I am boarded in child abuse pediatrics. I was actually opposed to the certification, not because I didn't pass the exam on first try, I did, but because I felt it was clearly in the domain of the pediatrician to really be comfortable with complex care, which is what child abuse is. So I guess that's the question for you is, what are the direct implications for medical education? What would change that tide in saying, no, we don't need to refer for heart murmur? Obviously, we know when a child is acutely ill that we need subspecialty referral. So your thoughts about that?
Well, it's a really good question. I mean, there was an article this month in Pediatrics where they looked at the competence of pediatric residents, that they're entrustable professional activities, and found out that even third-year pediatric residents didn't meet that level of training that they felt confident in saying they were able to be entrusted in for that care. I don't know whether the measurement tools are poor or whether our training is not good. In terms of child abuse, I don't really think we should have a 3-year child abuse fellowship program. You said we should, probably shouldn't have a fellowship program to begin with, but we certainly don't need a 3-year fellowship program. And I'll talk a little bit later about that whole issue of fellowship length.
Fred, I'm just wondering, is anybody modeling what the impact, for example, the failure to, 30% fill rate for nephrology positions, the impact on ICUs, the impact on cancer care, the impact on transplants? Is anybody starting to look at that when we don't have enough nephrologists to really manage all the complex
The
cases
answer is,
that
I don't think so. We didn't run into that at all. I mean, there may be health services researchers out there that are doing that, although now with potential disappearance of AHRQ, the funds to do that may really not be available. So the answer is, I don't know, and I haven't heard of that. So this brings us to the report. This was a report that was funded by 7 different organizations, including the Board of American Board of Pediatrics, the Academy of Pediatrics, NIH, Barbara Johnson Foundation, Annie Casey Foundation, Children's Hospital Association. And the statement of task was really to recommend strategies and actions to ensure an adequate pediatric subspecialty workforce to support access to high-quality care, as well as a robust research portfolio. It was not to redesign the overall healthcare system of pediatric care delivery. Tina Chan and Jim Perrin, soon after our committee was put together, started another committee to look at those very issues for the National Academy of Medicine. The committee had many challenges. I just said that there is limited evidence in many areas. Studies were often dated, and they used limited sampling methods. Many of these had low response rates, and some of them did not distinguish between general pediatricians and subspecialists. Many of them did not use a standard list of subspecialties. We used the ACJME list of subspecialties. Many of them had inconsistent definitions and conflation of terms. And unfortunately, there's a lack of robust data on patient outcomes. Is that child with constipation treated by a pediatric gastroenterologist doing better than a child treated with constipation by the general pediatrician? I don't think so, but there's no data on any of that. We had this vision for a high-quality workforce, well-supported, superbly trained, and appropriately used workforce, where there's effective education and training, there's well-designed care models, and continued attention to changing healthcare and healthcare economics. We felt that the subspecialists need to practice at the top of the scope of abilities and that there'd be appropriate reimbursement for their services. There certainly needs to be innovation in care delivery and flexible training pathways. So we had 4 goals to achieve this vision. One is promote collaboration, effective use of services between the primary care physicians and subspecialty physicians. And that's really where I think some of it has broken down, as you can see from the slide. It needs to be a reduction of financial and payment disincentives for people going to subspecialty care. We need to enhance education, training, recruitment, and retention of pediatric specialists. And we clearly need to support the pediatric physician scientist pathway. So going through these goals now, first of all, a larger workforce is not sufficient, may not be feasible. just showed you the ability to recruit individuals into subspecialty training programs that have been severely hampered. So we're not going to be able to get a large workforce, and it's not going to be sufficient either to deal with the problems. Clearly, the subspecialists need to focus on their essential roles, and the primary care clinicians can and should handle more of these problems that they're now referring to subspecialists. One thing we felt the AAP, the Committee on Council on Pediatric Subspecialties, and other groups should develop referral guidelines to reduce demand for care, primary care problems by these subspecialists sitting in our children's hospitals. I know our children's hospital in Seattle does have those referral guidelines. I suspect many of those at the children's hospitals do as well. One of the things that we need to really do is re-examine the frequency and need for return subspecialty visits. Chris Forrest looked at PEDSNET data and showed that 70% of visits to subspecialists are return visits, 70%. You think about it, why are many of those subspecialty return visits needed? A child with a heart murmur that the cardiologist feels is not a big deal, do they really need to come back and see that cardiologist in a year? I think we really need to carefully look at what's the rationale, what is the need for these return subspecialty visits, which then can open up a path for new patients to be seen by these subspecialists. It needs to be adequate reimbursement for evidence-based care delivery for these new models to enhance care, e-consults and telehealth. Certainly, telehealth went from 0 to 90 miles an hour during the pandemic and the first couple of weeks of the pandemic. We felt that Center for Medicaid and Medicare Services, private foundation, the health system should sponsor development and evaluations of innovations in the primary care specialty care interface. And that AHR2 should do a biannual report on changing the demands and needs, access to care, disparities of care, in general sense of specialty workforce, because there's no one else doing that right now. Just to show you our e-consult experience in Seattle, I know that many of your institutions are doing this as well. We started about a year ago, and here's data on the first 384 requests. 79% of these were accepted, 95% were completed within 3 days, and 64% were new patients. And you can see that the amount of time that specialists spent on these were 20 minutes or less in 93% of cases, 61% were 5 to 10 minutes. So e-consults works and does help to take care of many, many of the problems that don't really need to be seen in the office by a pediatric subspecialist. They provide a service to the primary care physician as well as to patients. Second goal was to reduce financial and payment disincentives. Now, you all know that commercial insurance rates are much higher than Medicare rates for subspecialists as well as for primary care clinicians. And Medicaid pays on the order of 67 to 78% of what Medicare pays. And there's only 5 states as of 2021 that had parity between Medicaid and Medicare rates. Here was probably at this point was a pipe dream, which should provide funds to states to increase Medicaid payments rates to achieve or exceed parity with Medicare within 5 years and make payment increases by states mandatory. One of the things we didn't want to see was that Congress provide increased funding for Medicaid payments, but then the states not to use that to provide parity. But we know now in Project 2025 would convert federal Medicaid funding to block grants or per capita caps. And therefore, Medicaid-Medicare parity is not likely to occur. We all hope that Medicaid would not be cut, decimate all of our children's hospitals. I know at our own children's hospital, 53% of our patients are covered by Medicaid. We also need to take a look at the RVU system. We know that the RVU system leads to lower payments for primary care and subspecialty care that are not procedural services. It's Medicare-driven, and it values pediatric work. And the Relative Value Scale Update Committee has 26 subspecialties. There's only one pediatric representative on that committee. And therefore, this basically the non-pediatric representatives are determining the RVUs for pediatric services for us. We felt that CMS should reform the RVU system and assign RVUs to reflect time and resource use for subspecialty care. This is not a new recommendation. There was a whole National Academy of Medicine report on the RVU system. You all know that it's really a broken system at this point. We also felt that to try to attract pediatric specialists is that the loan repayment program should be fully funded. We also felt that HRSA should focus on loan repayment programs for high priority pediatric and medical subspecialties, as well as those from disadvantaged backgrounds. Unfortunately, in the current administration plan, HRSA is being folded into another agency, so this may really not happen. So questions on those first two goals before we get on to training and pediatric research?
Your comment about why are we having a shortage, and you said, show me the money. And the question is, you know, with all the work that you've done, you did with this workforce, is that, how did you come to that conclusion? I mean, it's obvious to me and we hear it, but is there data that really continues to support that idea?
Some data. It's one of the factors that people use to decide whether which specialty to go to. It's not the only bit of data, but it's not the only thing that leads people to choose a particular career. But it certainly is one of the factors that plays into it. And if you look at the data, you know, the fact is that neonatology and cardiology, the two highest subspecialties, the highest paid subspecialties, have the highest fill rates of their fellowship programs. And adolescent medicine, developmental behavior, pediatrics, which are the poorest paid, have the lowest fill rates. So I think that it does play a role there.
I wonder if we define specialty care as downstream. My question is, you know, we look at primary care, but if we define primary care as only primary care by pediatricians, what's the other upstream effect of nurse practitioners and others who might well need to practice at the height of their training in the way that you've outlined, which would allow primary care to also extend the areas of comfort that they then practice in the scope of their practice. So it's not looking only downstream, but upstream of what's feeding that. The other is obviously parents and communities as educators in health promotion. So I wonder if your report addressed those kinds. That question does emerge for me as you present the data.
We did have two members of our panel who were nurse practitioners, and they were really pretty vocal about trying to make sure that nurse practitioners were part of the mix. Nurse practitioners are available to help both primary care physicians as well as subspecialists. On the other hand, there are no boards in pediatric practitioners as subspecialists, and they're really trained on the job, and they're trained by our subspecialists. And frankly, in our hospital, we've had one subspecialty where the nurse practitioners were paid by the hospital, made as much money as a faculty member, so specialist paid by the Department of Pediatrics. And that's a problem. Dr. Kenya McNeil tries.
Thank you. I think I had questions from the first set of slides. Sure. This is a similar presentation that I had to answer for our leadership in our healthcare system, specifically with regards to data for our IMG applicants. We know what the data looks like for MD and DO, but there's been almost a combination of what's considered IMG, and previously we broke those apart. So do you know if there's data that defines if IMG are truly those individuals who have trained in other countries who may have citizenship in other countries, or are they combining that data with those who are U.S. citizens and are training in the predominantly Caribbean medical schools? Because I think for a lot of individuals who've asked me that question, there is an impression that that is majority Caribbean medical schools. But in my work and with what I do with our residency programs in the ACGME, it's not. So do you know if that has been broken apart in some of that information?
I don't know if it has been. That data I showed you was from the AAMC, and I'm not sure if they've broken IMGs from people that were non-citizens who were born and trained elsewhere.
The only other question I had, I'm on the RC for the ACGME, and we have seen lots of applications for increased positions for fellowships, like new fellowship programs and complement increases. And so as we see that gap for a number of filled positions and some of this decrease with applications, we're noticing that we are actually increasing the capacity for positions, especially in subspecialty fellowships, but not necessarily having the applicant. So it makes our fill rate look significantly worse than what it is.
That's certainly part of the problem. But if you also look at the absolute numbers of people going into those fellowship programs, they haven't increased or in some cases have decreased. I mean, for example, with child abuse pediatrics, there are 10 individuals that went into it this year.
So I just wanted to comment that as a pediatric subspecialty surgeon, we have the same exact issues that we're finding that our fellowship programs are not filling at the same rate as our adult programs, which by and large pay more as a specialty than pediatric otolaryngology does, that our access problems are very similar to our pediatric colleagues. And I know that you your study focused really on the pediatricians, but I just want to comment that the pediatric surgery community is experiencing very, very similar situation.
Thanks for your comment. We, you know, at the beginning, we decided whether or not we were going to include pediatric surgery into this, and decided that wasn't within our scope, but I think it's really a very important point. So let's get to training. And frankly, the preparation of the pediatric subspecialty workforce has not evolved with time. We all know that the current model, as determined by the American Board of Pediatrics, is 3 years of fellowship, which includes 1 year of research. If you look at the data, 48% of board-certified subspecialists report not being involved in any research activities after they finished the fellowship program. Lowest are adolescent medicine, cardiology, developmental behavioral pediatrics, pediatric emergency medicine, neonatology. Only 7% report spending 50% or more of their time on research. And you can see that here, HEMONC and ID lead the list. So this idea of a one-size-fits-all fellowship model of 3 years, including 1 year of fellowship, really is, we challenge that. We know that some specialists need more years of clinical training. If you're going into cardiology and doing interventional cardiology, you're clearly going to need more years of clinical training. And we also know that 1 year of research training is not enough to make anybody competitive as a physician scientist for NIH research. They need more years of research training. Important to know that the American Board of Internal Medicine allows 2 year fellowships. So we called on the board to increase flexibility in fellowship design and length. We felt that the AMSPDEC with the board, ACG, and others should review and adjust the educational training curricula. American Board of Pediatrics and ACGME should develop, implement, evaluate distinct fellowship training programs, including two-year fellowships. And this will allow for tailoring training programs for specific career goals. I don't know how the new ACGME requirements for pediatrics will affect interest on some specialties. We'll have to see how that plays out. Now, this was a study that was published in Pediatrics in April of this year, and I wanted to bring it up because some of you may have seen it. This was a study, which was a survey of programs where they looked at whether fellows in the current three-year fellowship programs were competent after 2 years in their fellowship programs. And they used these clinical trustable professional activities as their marker for that. And they had the fellowship programs assess this. And they found out that 50% of fellows only met clinical APA supervision levels after 2 years of training, and 86 to 100% at 3 years of training. You may have heard about this, and obviously it was done with the idea that we need 3 years of fellowship. But it's a terribly flawed study. How can you survey individuals in a three-year fellowship program to see if they're competent at 2 years when the whole fellowship program was set up to be 3 years in length? Secondly, there's no evidence that the EPAs are valid measure of competence. And third, there's tremendous variation in how these are applied across these different programs. There's no specific direction how they should be applied. So we felt like this was a pretty flawed study, but it's out there, and it's an attempt to try to show that three-year fellowships are needed. So questions on training?
Thank you so much. I'm a pediatric intensivist, and one of the questions I had was, and this was discussed within our circles, is the concern that a two-year fellowship, if you have them in certain areas, would create almost a tiered or hierarchical type of training program that maybe if you went for a three-year fellowship or a two-year fellowship, you know, in critical care, that would somehow destine you to one or another. I mean, I don't know if there's been any comment on that, or if there's been any, if anybody has any thoughts on that, or if you have thoughts on that.
In our own Department of Pediatrics at the University of Washington, which is over 600 members, we have three different faculty tracks. We have the classic physician scientist, we have the classic clinician who doesn't do any research, and then the clinician scholars are in between to do some research, but the majority of their time is spent doing clinical care. A two-year fellowship, as you just mentioned, in critical care is not going to be suitable for somebody who wants to be a faculty scientist, but I think that it's going to be suitable for somebody who wants to be a straight clinician. So I think we need to not wholesale implement these changes, but I think we need to test those and see, does a two-year fellowship program, is that provide adequate clinical training for somebody? We also work very hard in our department to not make anybody feel like they're second-class citizens, as you suggest that might happen if you have a two-year fellowship versus a three-year fellowship. everybody contributes to the mission of our department, to the mission of our hospital, and we don't distinguish between one being a lower class citizen than the other. Okay, I'll move on now to the physician scientist, which is clearly an important part of the subspecialty workforce. As I already said, training for this can't be accomplished in 12 months of scholarly activity within a 3-year overall fellowship. It needs much more intensive research training to be. And you have to realize that physician scientists, as you all know, are competing against PhDs who might be a 5-6 years training plus a postdoc training of 2-4 years to compete at NIH for research grants. So physician scientists need to really be well-trained in research to be competitive and to do high-quality science. So we felt there need to be specific efforts to encourage and facilitate entry into research careers and foster the early phases of a career development for pediatric physician scientists, especially for those who are underrepresented currently in the extramural scientific workforce. We've made these recommendations, which right now we have no idea whether this will happen or not. NIH should increase the number of career development awards in pediatrics, including individual K awards, as well as institutional K programs. I was on NICHD Council a number of years back when Diana Bianchi first started as the director of NICHD. And at that time, the shift was really to more individual K awards, the institutional K programs, because they looked at the data and found out that individuals who were on individual Ks were more successful in the K-to-R transition than those who are on institutional K programs. We all know that the current funding provided by NIH for salaries is inadequate and requires cost share, which makes it really quite difficult for some departments to be able to do that. NICHD, for example, only provides $25,000 towards project expenses per year, which is actually very inadequate. And therefore, we need to have them increase that as well as institutions to support those kinds of fundings. There was no central repository for data on a qualitative and quantitative measures of funding and success. None. We felt that NIH should work with other funders and foundations to create such a central repository so we can really see what's the success and understand what happens to pediatric physician scientists in the workforce. The National Academy of Medicine had a statement in this past October on the U.S. Biomedical Research Enterprise. And one of the priorities was emphasizing the importance of physician scientists in the biomedical research enterprise and to support their training, education, and professional work. So that's out there. Again, whether this will happen in the current economic climate at NIH is completely unknown. For the report, we concluded that the current healthcare system is expensive, care is not equitably accessible, and it's not fully satisfying either to the people who works it serves. Requires the willingness of those organizations to adapt to the changing needs of children and physicians and a changing healthcare delivery system. And women will be the main drivers of this change, given the increased proportion of women in the profession and academia in general. So I'll take questions now, and then I have some slides about, really from my point of view as a prior editor, on women in academics. Dr. Hillmeyer.
Thank you. Very, very nice presentation. I think you've done a nice job in pointing out what I think are some of the major issues in the shortage that we have in many of the pediatric specialties. One of the arguments against going to 2-year programs that I've heard people express is that you will actually lower the number of people who become physician scientists by reducing the exposure that they have to that type of research activity. Have you had any models about this or heard other people talk about ways to deal with this concern?
Well, I guess I would look to internal medicine. So internal medicine, like my son is an adult nephrologist. And in his nephrology program here at the University of Washington, they have 2-year clinical fellowships and they have 4-year research fellowships. So, you know, they've been successful in doing it. And I don't understand why pediatrics can't do the same thing. We have this natural experiment. It's worked for internal medicine. Why wouldn't it work for pediatrics? Dr. Stapleton.
The American Board already has a special pathway that for selected individuals, 2 years of general pediatrics and 3 years of science and fellowship training can qualify for board sitting for, certification. You know, has any thought been given to make that more general in years past, back when years ago, when I was a resident fellow, that it was possible to have a 2+3 versus a 3+3.
I think there's been some discussion about how do we change the pediatric residency training programs that can feed into subspecialties better, as well as equip the general pediatricians better. And it may be that we have greater number of two-year pediatric residency programs to then feed into these subspecialty trainings, as well as then continue on a three-year fellowship or a three-year training program for the general pediatrician practice. So I think there's talk about that, whether that will happen or not, I don't know. American Board of Pediatrics has really, frankly, resisted a lot of these kinds of changes. Dr. McNeil, Trice?
I had a question that went back a little bit to, I believe, may have been your first or second set of slides with regards to our workforce and referrals for our subspecialty right. providers. When I think about, when I explain kind of the scope of workforce, having done some grant work with that, we often define that for pediatrics as pediatricians, but also broaden that scope to think of anyone who's going to take care of a child. So that includes not only pediatricians, but our advanced practice providers, but also our family medicine and emergency right. medicine docs who have historically been trained in the expertise of pediatrics by pediatricians. And a lot of the feedback that we have received from especially some of our subspecialty providers on the with regards to the type of consults or referrals that they're getting that should be in the general pediatric scope, is that they're getting them not necessarily from general pediatricians, but more so from advanced practice providers and other folks who take care of kids who may not have that type of training. So do you know if that data is out there, if the referrals for constipation and things and reflux that generally we have that we care for in the scope is actually not coming from general pediatric providers, but maybe APPs or family medicine or emergency medicine or urgent care providers who haven't seen the numbers. Do you know if that's broken down anywhere?
It is, and you're right in that a high proportion of those are coming from non-pediatric providers, particularly the advanced nurse practitioners. And I think that, again, gets into where something like an e-consult can really be helpful, because e-consult will help the family from traveling to a children's hospital for care, but it also provides education back to that pediatric provider so that the next time they have a child with severe constipation, they can better handle it and not refer it to the gastroenterologist. But there's also, I think, a call for, to me, there's a need for better training of those advanced nurse practitioners. Right now, it's really, to me, a relatively unregulated field in that people sort of do training on the job without any kind of certification that they're trained to take care of these problems. Dr. Rubin?
Thank you. I don't know if you have the Canadian perspective, but classically, that's a 4+2 training where you do 3 years of general pediatrics, and then your fourth year can either be a year of clinical subspecialty work or an additional year of general pediatrics. And those that opt for that 1 year of subspecialty work often will go into general pediatrics with a special interest in many of these bread and butter things in that specialty.
Right.
Those who choose to go on to do the typical traditional fellowship for two additional years mirrors that in the States. But I wonder if that might be an opportunity to evaluate how that has played out. I know that in Canada, many of our primary pediatricians see far more of the bread and butter, leaving the specialists to do more practice at a higher level.
I think that's terrific. We did not look at the Canadian model, but I think that's exactly what we really are calling on programs like the ACGME and American Board of Pediatrics. So look at those other models and try to develop some new models here for our training in the United States. There are clearly examples out there that we should be looking at. Dr. Edwards?
Yes, thank you. I actually have two questions. The first question regards the subspecialties in using the e-consults. And did you find that there were some subspecialties where those were much more efficient and effective than others? And so is that an area that works well for everyone or works well for certain groups more effectively than others?
Well, we really didn't have a lot of data on it because these e-consults really just now are beginning to be rolled out for that. And our institution, I think it's really worked very well for a lot of things like rheumatology, infectious diseases, developmental behavior pediatrics, and telehealth, you know, works very well for mental health care of children, which is obviously a whole big area of need.
Good. And certainly more data will be available. The second question that I've really pondered and really struggled with is how to get more physician scientists. And I think that it probably needs to be done before actually the fellowship time, and whether it's in the medical schools, it's in the MD, PhD programs, and in the residency. And Do you have thoughts about that, or do you think that there would be some additional work that needs to be done in trying to help in this area? Because it may be by the time that they get to the fellowship, they've decided they don't want to do the actually physician scientist track, but maybe before that might be a better place. So what are your thoughts about that?
Well, I agree with you. I think that, you know, there needs to be attention to the whole pathway of medical education and potentially starting in college, where people are doing research in college as part of their college experience, and certainly in medical school. I don't know how feasible it is to do it during residency, particularly if we talk about having a two-year residency program. It really wouldn't be time to do it then. But I do think that there needs to be attention to it earlier on in people's academic careers so that they can understand what is research and is it something that's of interest to them. But I think that research exposure needs to be more than just, you know, working in a lab and working with rats. I think it needs to be kind of health services research, epidemiological research, community-based pediatric research. Those kinds of research experiences are important to do, because you see this all the time where somebody did some research in a lab and then they say, well, I don't really like research. Well, you may not like bench research, but you may be like very suitable to do epidemiology research or community-based research. So I think we need to really broaden those research experiences.
We're beginning to look a little bit about, you know, sometimes I feel that the goal is to treat them and street them rather than to think about pathogenesis and, you know, how this relates. And I think maybe if we can focus a little bit on the residency education that may be more science driven or science based than actually pragmatic, that might be helpful as well, but we're trying. Thank you.
Thanks. Dr. Sugarman.
Fred, thank you. To follow up on Dr. Edwards' question a little bit more on the e-consults, are there data out there on patient and family satisfaction with e-consults and on the other side, physician satisfaction with providing e-consults? I mean, I think you gave compelling data that they can get done and they can get done, you know, quickly and efficiently. But I was just curious, is there anything out there yet about overall satisfaction with them?
This is not an area that I follow, but, you know, I know from our own experience at Seattle Children's, Jack Salerno, who's managed this program, has said that they've been very successful, that they're popular and among physicians, and they've been acceptable to patients because, again, patients don't have to travel to the hospital. They can get their problem solved much easier and quicker than waiting for months to be seen by a subspecialist. So I think the early data on them are that they are successful. Since Bruder asked me to talk a little bit about women in medicine, because to prep for the next session that you will have, and I thought I'd talk about three different areas. And a lot of this is based upon my experience as a editor, as well as a vice chair in the department for many years. So here's some data on opportunities to do research and publish during medical school. The left slides are top 40 schools for NIH grants, and the right columns are not top 40 schools. And you can see men and women here. So on the whole, women may have slightly more research exposure during medical school, not a whole lot, but a little bit more. But men end up publishing more than they do women in after that research experience. So this included MD, PhD candidates as well. So there is some research experience that people are getting, and women seem to have as much as men. But here is something that you all know and are concerned about, and this is success rates in R01 equivalent grants. This is not success rates, but it's number of awards. So you can see here the male, or the dark blue, male or the lighter blue, and the line or percentage of females. So you can see here is that during this period of NIH funding doubling, there was a big increase in funds to men, and then it went down, and then it's kind of come back up again. But it's been relatively flat. But overall, you can see that the number of funding by women here has really increased fairly dramatically in the last 7 or 8 years. And as a result now, about 40% of the grants are going to women. And here are success rates by type of application. So the dark ones are new applications, the lighter ones are renewal applications. And you can see here in the new applications that the success rate of men and women are really about the same. If women are not, a little bit higher than are men. And in terms of renewal applications, they're really were higher by men before, but now they're equivalent between men and women. So I think in terms of success rates, that women are very competitive, as competitive as are men. But there are still some problems here. So one of the things is looking at women as authors of important papers. So one thing you think about cardiovascular disease is lots of, it's not pediatric issues, obviously, but adult medicine trials. And pivotal trials are the trials that the FDA uses to decide whether or not to approve a novel drug. Here is a study that showed there are 53 trials for new cardiovascular drugs between 2008 and 2020. The median number of men and women authors of these trial publications was 9 for men and only 1 for women. And proportion of women as first and senior authors was really much low. So there's a problem here in things in terms of women being involved with these really critically important studies. And then, you know, there's invited commentaries. I mean, one of the ways for women to have their careers promoted and for them to be known is to be invited to write commentaries. Let me just sort of walk you through this. This was a study of authorship in 2459 medical journal articles. And this is the number of years that you're active. And people who are active down here, this represents about 38 years being active. Well, up here, this represents about 8 years being active. So people who have been around a long time, the vast majority of those commentaries are by men. People that are here around for less time, women do better, but they're still mostly men. So I think, again, that's an issue that we need to work on, which is how do we get those individuals to be invited to write commentaries? And so this is a study done by Melina Kibbe. So Melina is the editor-in-chief of JAMA Surgery. Some of our surgery colleagues on the call may know her. She is now the dean of the University of Virginia, but she still remains as editor of JAMA Surgery. So back in January to June of 2023, she looked at who was being invited to write a commentary by gender. And you can see that the majority of these were men, 63% were men. And so she made a conscious effort to change that and instead to really promote inviting women to invite commentaries. And you can see that in the second half of 2023, that 65% were women. So she really flipped that. And then she looked at the number of citations. And this is obviously just a short period of time, so the number of citations are really small. But you can see that the commentaries by women were as likely to be cited, if not more likely to be cited, than those cited, those written by men. So I think she made the point here in this article published in JAMA Surgery that we can overcome this if we recognize our implicit bias and specifically invite women. And the idea that there's not enough qualified women to write these commentaries is just not true. There clearly are plenty of qualified women to write these commentaries. We just need to really overcome those implicit bias and invite them to write those commentaries. And then here's some data that you probably also are familiar with from 2021 AAMC, looking at the number of women versus men in these roles. And you can see here in academic affairs, medical education, 53% were men, 47% women. Admissions, it switched with 56% women. Clinical affairs, though, 71% men. And then diversity were more women. Faculty affairs, more women. But then research affairs, more men. So there's still really great bias in terms of who gets to be in these leadership positions. In pediatrics, I found this article that was published in JAMA Neurocopa, the article, the journal I used to edit. They did a systematic review of studies published between 2019 and 2022. And women are underrepresented when stratified by tier of dean, with only 40% lower tier deans, in other words, not the, there may be associate deans, and only 18.9% of medical school deans, 28 out of 148. In pediatrics, 61% of all faculty were women, but only 31% were chairs. And they represent the majority of division director roles in pediatric hospital medicine, but underrepresented in other areas like pediatric gastroenterology and pediatric critical care medicine. So pediatrics still has a big problem, that we have 60% of our faculty are women. They're normally not in the leadership roles yet.
Fred, thank you for that wonderful review. It really highlighted some really important issues. And Fred's presentation will be available on the Career Physician website under Insights in the future. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us for today's discussion. If you have a question for our council or have a future topic suggestion, please connect with us at pediatricinsight.com. The Child Health Advisory Council is comprised of a diverse group of emeritus deans, department chairs, division chiefs, and child health executives recognized for their leadership contributions in academic pediatrics and child health. The CHAC's impact is further bolstered by council specialty advisors who are active current national leaders in each of the subspecialties in pediatrics. Collectively, the 30 plus members of the CHAC bring unmatched wisdom and experience to career physicians' executive search and leadership development endeavors for its clients. Our council members include the following physicians: Bruder Stapleton, Christine Gleason, Craig Hillemeyer, Renee Jenkins, Danielle LaRocque Arena, Valerie Opopari, Bruce Rubin, Robert Sawin, and Arnold Strauss. To view our council members' bios, please visit careerphysician.com and click on the Child Health Advisory Leadership tab.